This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740.
Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
Welcome to the Audio Imaginarium. Come on in. Hang your cloak on a peg, grab a stool, come gather around the fire. There are stories to be told, and you are among friends. Welcome to winter. Donald Jeffries is standing by as we get ready to commemorate the anniversary of President John F. Kennedy's assassination. Don is the author of Hidden History, an expose of modern crimes, conspiracies, and cover-ups in American politics. Before that, let me introduce the band. On the Gibson flying guitar, my technical producer, Ian Robertson, here again tonight. On the other side of the glass, twisting the knobs and dials. And on the Rickenbacker bass guitar and theremin, Albert Vinzel, my story producer. Also in studio tonight, our fine young intern, Ryan White. Let's say hello to Ryan. Ryan is...
How's it going there?
Hey, Ryan, how are you? Welcome aboard.
Well, thank you. Welcome.
Ryan was one of my former broadcast students at Durham College and a fine young gentleman, and we're very happy to have him aboard as an intern here on the program. Before we get Don Jeffries in here, Albert, my occasional remote viewer friend, what's in the box?
We've got a bunch of guesses coming in on Twitter.
And I don't want – yeah, we'll get to the Twitter guesses in a minute. But I want you to really focus, Albert, because you've had a rough couple of weeks. And I know what's happening. You're off your game because you're guessing. You're not following the remote viewing protocols.
But part one is guessing is the AOL. So my guess is spoon or like something metallic. And that's under notifications. We got – Bellatrix, he's guessing.
No. I want to know what you think. Hang on. Never mind the Twitter. Just tell me what you think. You're saying it's a spoon?
I could be way off because there's like the desire to know and the ability to focus. But once you're in that zone and you hear that still small voice, then you'll be 100% right.
And what is the still small voice telling you?
I haven't got there. You've got to be in that relaxed state. And that's the trick is to get to that zone.
All right. Well, I'll give you a little more time, but what we'll do is at the bottom of the hour, if people want to guess, or not guess, I don't want you to guess. I want you to utilize your remote viewing skills, and you can send us a tweet. Use the hashtag What's in the Box, and if you're close, we'll announce it at the near the bottom of the hour, just after the bottom of the hour. And I've got some books from my private library I've cobbled together, but you need to be within driving distance of the radio station to pick those up because we're not going to mail those out. That would be cost prohibitive, as the kids like to say. So what's in the box? Use the hashtag what's in the box. And Albert, try listening to that small, quiet voice, and we'll check in with you later. We should also point out on the app, if you haven't already downloaded the free app for The Conspiracy Show, please do so. And there's a new feature on the app that Sharon Forster, our wonderful app developer, has put on there. And it's a remote viewing experiment that you can do on your own. It has nothing to do with what's in the box, so check that out. And again, Conspiracy Show app is free download, from Google Play and the Apple Store. In the first edition of his book, Hidden History, Don Jeffries writes, "I can remember when believing in conspiracies wasn't cool. Now, in the second decade of the 21st century, more people are starting to sense that things may not be as they appear." Or to put it another way, after the WikiLeaks revelations of the last several months, I think we can all say 2016 is the year you owe all of your paranoid friends a beer. Here we are, 53 years and counting since the assassination of JFK, and the alternative media is dominating over traditional media outlets like CNN, MSNBC, even the New York Times, etc. And conspiracies are becoming increasingly mainstream. Don Jeffries has been researching the JFK assassination since the mid-1970s when he was a student volunteer with Mark Lane's Citizens Committee of Inquiry. He is the author of the 2007 novel The Unreals. He recently published the third edition of Hidden History with a new foreword by Roger Stone, longtime friend of President-elect Donald Trump and an advisor to the successful Trump campaign. Don Jeffries, welcome back to The Conspiracy Show. How are you?
Fine, thanks, Richard. Thanks for having me.
Did I get that right? It's the third edition that just came out, right?
The first one sold out. They had a second printing, so yeah, technically, I guess it is the third.
Right. I have the first edition, not the, the new one with the Roger Stone foreword. However, I mentioned Roger Stone, who wrote the foreword to the third edition. Obviously, he's an admirer of your work, and he knows the soon to be president very well. He's had many conversations with him over the years. I'm wondering whether Roger has communicated this to you, or whether you happen to know whether Hidden History might be the kind of book that Trump would be interested in, because I think you mentioned to me before he is interested in conspiracies.
Oh, I hope so. I don't know. He hasn't contacted me, has it? Yeah, I'd love to think maybe maybe Roger. I don't know if Roger ever got around to mentioning it to him, or how much he actually talks to him now. Roger is very busy. I haven't talked to him for a while, but yeah, I'd love to think that. Boy, it would certainly help to have Trump holding my book up on television.
But do you? Your sense, did Roger ever say whether Trump is? Maybe I heard that from another quarter that Trump is actually has talked to Roger about conspiracies. He's interested in this stuff.
No, he has. He did tell me that. He told me before that you would love this guy because he's only coming out with a very little bit of what he actually believes, and then he knows all this stuff, and he's just hints of it come out and things that he says. So that's what Roger Stone says. So that would be amazing. Maybe we'd be the first genuine conspiracy theorist in the White House.
Do you think, for example, Trump would be a guy that would consider reopening the 9/11 investigation?
Well, there have been hints of that, too. There's a quote out there. I've never been able to really completely verify it, but if Trump actually said it, where he talked about Building 7, which is huge. And if you're talking about Building 7, you understand how implausible the official scenario is. And he did say something about that. And there have been rumors about that. Now, whether that would actually happen, boy, that would be the most controversial thing that he's ever said or done.
Right. JFK. I think we're on the same page on this, that the JFK assassination is kind of a coup d'etat, or was it kind of a coup d'etat, taking over the executive branch, the national security state, the military-industrial complex. Do you think, let me just stay with this Trump vein of questioning for a moment yet. Do you think Trump's victory, when you look at all of the powerful forces that lined up in opposition to him, the political establishment of both parties, the corporate-controlled mainstream media, do you think Trump's victory is a first step in recapturing the executive branch, the presidency?
Well, it could be. And I'm withholding judgment. I'm obviously willing, because I supported Trump because of some of his really bold statements and the real hatred that he elicited from every corner of the establishment. I said many times that that's the greatest thing about Trump, is the fact that he certainly has the right kind of enemies. But so far, the appointments he's made or rumors of his appointments have been a little troubling to me. I'm not real happy with what I've heard so far about that. So I hope we start to see some real fresh faces in there, not the old establishment people, because if he's going to drain the swamp, it's hard to have people like Mitt Romney in there, and John Bolton has been mentioned, just would really be an awful pick. So hopefully they don't actually get in there, but of course, I'm willing to give Trump a chance, but I said at the outset that, you know, this is almost too good to be true that we could have somebody in there that really some of the things Trump has said. So we'll see what happens, but the cabinet will be telling, and I would want to see at least some outside face. Certainly love to see a Ron Paul or a Pat Buchanan in there, but haven't been any rumors of them being nominated for anything.
Donald Jeffries, author of A Hidden History, an expose of modern crimes, conspiracies, and cover-ups in American politics. Last week on the program, we were also talking JFK. I interviewed Peter Janney, and we talked about Mary Pinchot Meyer, one of JFK's mistresses. And I don't know, do you know Peter? Have you talked with Peter?
I don't know him. I read Mary's Mosaic. You know, it was a very interesting book.
Yeah, I just wanted to pursue that a little bit with you. Janney's father was in the CIA, and during his research, he actually, you know, got the shock of his life as he discovers his own father was likely involved in Meyer's death. And I'm just wondering about that journal. You know, whenever there's sort of a high-profile murder, whether it was Marilyn Monroe and then we have Mary Pinchot Meyer, there's always this journal that goes disappearing. And obviously it would appear that she knew something about JFK's death, who was responsible, and that's why she was killed. What are your thoughts about what may have been in that journal?
Well, I think you said it yourself, the fact that it was destroyed, and apparently it was James Jesus Angleton, and yes, Jesus was his middle name, one of the most curious figures ever to grace the CIA, who supposedly went to her house and I think burned it in the fireplace. You know, when that kind of stuff happens and the CIA is involved, and actually her husband was Cord Meyer, mm-hmm. If you read Hidden History, he's at the back of a lot of these projects for fomenting false opposition. On the left, especially, you know, fake magazines, fake dissent. I believe he worked with Gloria Steinem, if I'm not mistaken. But yeah, certainly the way she died. I mean, again, when you look at all the unnatural deaths that are associated with these, to get murdered like that, and coming from the background she did, you know, when you're running in those type of high circles, you shouldn't be prone to just random violence that would happen if you live in a really poverty-stricken area. So when that happens, and given her background and her connections, regardless of how real any you know, affair with JFK was, or how involved she was with him as far as policy or in trying to influence him or anything, I think her death alone and the fact that apparently her journal was destroyed shows that she was murdered by some powerful forces. I don't for a second think it was a random act of violence that they blamed on the person they blamed it on.
Yeah, Ray Crump Jr.
Yeah.
And again, it's interesting, the patterns here when they choose a patsy, when they nabbed, before they even nabbed Oswald in the theater in Dallas, and I don't, you can tell me whether you think this story is true, the idea that Fletcher Prouty, who, of course, was Mr. X in Oliver Stone's JFK, Donald Sutherland. Fletcher Prouty's off on this wild goose chase in New Zealand, and he picks up a newspaper, and he's reading all about Oswald's background and how he's been charged with the president's murder. He immediately calls Washington, and at that moment, they hadn't even nabbed Oswald in the theater yet. Is that true, do you think, that story?
Well, there's been some dispute about it, but certainly if it is true, it says a lot about the powers of the people that assassinated JFK. And we do, there's enough stuff out there that we know is true. For instance, we do know that McGeorge Bundy, who people always ask me for names, and he was a national security advisor at JFK, I think it can be reasonably inferred that he had foreknowledge of the assassination simply because he was in the White House Situation Room at the time, and he assured all of JFK's cabinet members who were in the air flying back from Hawaii for a conference. He assured them that there was no conspiracy, and this is only a couple hours after the assassination when no investigation had been done at all. So there's no way he could possibly have known that sitting in the White House Situation Room. But he did that, and I think that he's a culpable, not to mention the fact that he's also the one that wrote National Security Action Memorandum 273, which was written actually before JFK was assassinated.
Let me just jump in here, Donald. Forgive the intrusion. We'll take a time out. We'll come back to that memorandum George McBundy, the JFK assassination, and much more. Hidden History, an expose of modern crimes, conspiracies, and cover-ups in American politics. Stay with us.
Big Brother is listening, and so are you. To The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio. To speak with Richard, call 416-360-0740 or toll free 1-866-740-4740. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740. Peering into the shadows, where the truth often hides. You're listening to The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Donald Jeffries is with us. The book, Hidden History, an expose of modern crimes, conspiracies, and cover-ups in American politics, with a foreword by Roger Stone. We were talking about McGeorge Bundy, who was national security advisor to both Kennedy and LBJ. And you mentioned a rather strange phone call he made to Kennedy's staff who were flying back from Hawaii. It's interesting. They were all sort of madly off in all directions. Prouty was sent to New Zealand. Other staff sent to Hawaii. So on their way back, McGeorge Bundy calls them and says what, Donald?
He reassures them that there was no conspiracy. And that's exactly what he said. And again, this is just impossible. It would be impossible for him to have known that even if he was in Dallas, which he wasn't. He was far away in Washington, D.C., in the White House Situation Room. He did that. I think that makes him culpable, at least of having foreknowledge, especially in conjunction with knowing he's the person who wrote National Security Action Memorandum 273, which was actually the first draft was written by him before the assassination. Now, he had to have known that John F. Kennedy would never have signed it because it totally contradicted National Security Action Memorandum 263, which JFK had just put out, and it delineated his withdrawal policy from Vietnam. 273, which Johnson signed as quickly as he possibly could, contradicted Kennedy's plans, and of course, we know what happened after that. The escalation began, and the rest of the 1960s happened. So those two events, I believe, the phone call and the fact I don't believe an innocent staffer would possibly have written something which he had to have known if JFK saw it, would just said, you know, what are you doing? That completely contradicts everything that we want to do in Vietnam. So I think he did that because he must have known that JFK wouldn't have been around to sign it.
That sounds extraordinary to me, that a national security advisor would draft a memorandum. Isn't that only under the president's purview?
Well, it is that, but it typically they would draft it, and then I guess the president would revise it, and of course the president has to approve it. But that's the important thing, is that he drafted this, and there was no need for it because, as I said, it completely contradicted the very recent, I believe it had only been a month before, that National NSAM 263 came out. Of course, Oliver Stone made quite a bit of that, and with good cause, because that was, I believe, the most important indication of the change that happened with JFK's death. You know, a lot of these, especially the liberals, the Noam Chomskys of the world, like to portray it as Kennedy wouldn't have done anything different, nothing changed with his death, when in fact, we have the evidence of those National Security Action Memorandums very clearly showing what a huge change happened as a result of the change of the administration.
There are still some important documents relating to the assassination yet to be released. I believe members of the House Select Committee on Assassinations, which was established in, I think, 1976. And I believe some of the members of that committee saw these documents. I think some of the members of the Church Committee also saw these documents that are to be, that are sealed until 2029. What is the scuttlebutt on what is it significant information in those documents? Could this blow the lid off the assassination in 2029?
I doubt very seriously there's any kind of smoking gun there. I've always said that I don't think that you're going to find anything in there where the assassination plot is detailed and people are signing their names to it. I mean, I'm sure there's some interesting information in there. Certainly, there's no reason for anything to be withheld, and of course, that was one of the very strong indications that there was not a lone nut unconnected to anything, for the fact that anything would be classified in the grounds of national security if Lee Harvey Oswald was simply a minimum wage earning loser who wanted to impress his wife, that what would possibly be withheld on the grounds of national security. But we see this all the time. I mean, you still have information, I believe, that Scotland Yard is withholding about Jack the Ripper. You know, that was talking about 1888.
So right, right.
There's just a strong impulse on the part of those in authority to withhold and suppress. And regardless of what's actually in that information, it clearly looks like they're suppressing something for sinister purposes.
You mentioned the Executive Memorandum 263, which was one of the big losers, I think, in that would have been, had it not been reversed, would have been a company like Bell Helicopter. Obviously,
yeah.
You know, they made their bones with the war in Vietnam.
Absolutely.
And then we have people associated with Bell Helicopter that were also associated with Lee Harvey Oswald, and that would be the Paines.
Right.
Talk to me about the connection between the Paines, Oswald, and Bell Helicopter.
Well, the Paines, what's really amazing, all the deaths that have happened, and of course it was 53 years ago, so at this point you would expect a good number of deaths to be have occurred that where people were associated with the Kennedy assassination. But the Paines, both Ruth and Michael Paine, are still alive, amazingly enough. So if there was an honest investigation conducted, you could still get, I believe the Paines were involved in what I would call setting Lee Harvey Oswald up as the patsy on the ground level. I believe, as Jim Garrison did, that Lee Harvey Oswald was a low-cover undercover agent with somebody, the FBI, CIA, Naval Intelligence, someone. And he was told at the time of the assassination, or right before that, that he was on assignment to infiltrate what he was told was a brewing plot to potentially assassinate President Kennedy. So I think he was actually trying to stop that, and I believe that's why he interacted with the Paines, who I believe were just kind of put in the bin. And as you mentioned, they had connections not only to the Bell Helicopter, but Ruth Paine, and especially had connections to the CIA, Michael Paine. Clearly, there's even a, you know, 6 degrees of separation thing where Alan Dulles's was one of his mistresses was the best friend of, I believe, Michael Paine's mother or something. It's just, you know, these connections are incredible when you examine them, but they weren't just some random couple, you know, in Texas that happened to intermingle, just as George de Morenschild, who was even a more interesting character, who actually had dated Lee Harvey, Jacqueline Kennedy's, Onassis's mother as a youngster. And that's the circles he ran in, and he was with the white Russian community, really a virulent anti-communist, and yet somehow, and I believe he was probably 40 years older or more than Lee Harvey Oswald, something like that, yet somehow he becomes the best friend of this Marxist, 22-year-old, 24-year-old, that had just, you know, renounced his citizenship and came back and was, you know, reading the Daily Worker and was a minimum wage earner. It just, that just doesn't pass the smell test. It just, on so many levels, the age factor, the philosophical factor, and the economic factor, you're just not going to have somebody who had, you know, had the point where he was raised in circles where he could be dating, you know, a Bouvier as a young man would possibly be the point where he would want to socialize and intermingle with someone like Lee Harvey Oswald.
Don Jeffries is with us. Hidden History, an expose of modern crimes, conspiracies, and cover-ups in American politics. Just getting back to the Paines for a moment, wasn't it Ruth Paine who convinced Marina Oswald to move out, sort of isolating Lee Harvey Oswald?
Yeah, well, they had a very curious living arrangement where Lee Harvey Oswald, who we're told had no money, was making minimum wage, somehow put out the extra money to rent a room. You know, he lived in a rooming house that was near his work, and then on the weekends he would ride home with Buell Wesley Fraser, and that's, of course, the guy that rode him to work that day, the fateful day. But in the meantime, Marina and first the one child, she was pregnant with her second, and then she had the second baby girl, were living with Ruth Paine, who was estranged from Michael Paine, but they were still good friends. In other words, just a weird relationship between the Paines to begin with. They were living apart, but and there's some indication, if you look at some of the letters, I remember Michael Edhouse, who wrote the Oswald file way back when, one of his letters he produced, it certainly looks like a love letter from Ruth to Marina, where she seems to be like in love with her, have some kind of a infatuation with her. But we're told on the surface that they were living there, that Ruth was letting Marina live there, and she helped with her own kid, with the Paine children, and she would also teach Ruth Russian. That was supposedly the reason. But it just seemed like a strange relationship for the husband to be living, who had made no money, who had a rooming house, and why he couldn't have lived there too, I don't know. He certainly should have been able to ride to work every day with Frazier, who lived in the neighborhood. And of course, Ruth Payne also is the one who, if you're speculating that she was kind of maneuvering him around at the ground level, she's the one that got him the job at the Texas School Book Depository. And so her fingerprints are all around there. If you read my book, I have lots of stuff in there about her, where she had marked her calendar in an odd way that indicated that she knew when Oswald had supposedly ordered the rifle, which, of course, really is like so much of this evidence. If you look behind it, almost all the incriminating evidence against Oswald, especially of a personal nature, that he beat his wife and so forth, it all comes from the testimony of Ruth Payne or Marina's ever-changing testimony. So she's somebody who I think in an honest investigation, she would have really been grilled about just the strange relationship there and her background. But, of course, the authorities were not going to go there. And she's somebody that apparently she's very lawsuit-friendly. So I have to be careful what I say here, because when Oliver Stone made his movie, she was, I believe, the only person where he had to invent a fictitious name for it. I think she threatened to sue him if she even portrayed her as, you know, as the person in history who she was.
I'm guessing Hidden History has been thoroughly lawyered, though, hasn't it not?
I hope so. I haven't heard anything. So, yeah.
All right. Well, that's your publisher's job, right?
I mean, I don't accuse. I mean, I'm sitting there with this. When I say that, it's just speculation that everybody's had that.
Sure.
You know, she was running. We don't. I mean, you know, maybe she was just a Quaker that was connected to that, and then later the Sandinistas, and you know, all this. Maybe she was just a peace activist, but
sure.
I think her connections are curious, and the fact that she, you know, was intermingled with Lee Harvey Oswald should warrant some scrutiny.
The famous picture of Oswald holding up the murder weapon and at the same time the the communist literature, the pamphlets and so
right.
forth, the newspaper, the Workers' Party newspaper, that
right.
was taken in Ruth Payne's backyard, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was actually taken at the it wasn't her backyard, but it was something that I go into quite a bit in the book as well, because Marina's story about that, and anyone who's looked at the photographs and see him, I mean, he appears to be standing in an angle that's just impossible without falling over, and the overkill involved, where he had the rifle, the pistol supposedly used to kill off her certificate, and for good measure, the communist literature. What would be the purpose, other than trying to incriminate yourself in a future crime, or crimes in this case, what would be the point of that? I mean, did he know he was also going to shoot a police officer? I mean, it's just absurd. And again, Marina's testimony, and this is just, I go into it somewhat in Hidden History, and it's just really absurd. John Armstrong and his Harvey and Lee did a really good job of really in-depth going over Marina's testimony. And House Select Committee on Assassinations found her so incredible that they actually wrote, I believe, a 32-page report that just detailed all her ever-changing testimony. It's maddening. And she was the Warren Commission star witness. And, and of course, that wouldn't have been allowed. She wouldn't have been allowed to testify her husband in a courtroom.
One of the few witnesses that actually appeared before Earl Warren was Jack Ruby.
Yeah.
And there's a very interesting exchange in your book between Warren and Ruby, of course, the gunman who killed Oswald during the infamous prison transfer a few days after the assassination of JFK. What was the purpose? I mean, it's very bizarre, that conversation. Just give us sort of a synopsis of what happened, what transpired in that conversation, that testimony.
Well, yeah, I have, like I said, as you noted, lots of excerpts from it, and it has to be read to be believed. I mean, it's like something out of a bad movie. Ruby is basically begging Earl Warren and the commission, and it was also one of the few witnesses that Gerald Ford appeared before, the future president of the United States. Most of the testimony of the Warren Commission was taken by staff members, like Arlen Specter, the future senator. But in this case, Earl Warren was there, Gerald Ford was there, I believe Alan Dulles was there. And he was basically begging. He said, "Gentlemen, my life is in danger here. I can't tell you the truth unless I get out of Dallas." And they're just, Earl Warren is saying, "Well, you know, there's a lot involved in that, Mr. Ruby." And it's unbelievable to watch, because Ruby is basically pleading for his safety to be taken out of Dallas. And here you have what. And at one point, and I think I was one of the first writers to notice this, that Earl Warren alludes to the fact that basically they would never even have called him as a witness unless Ruby's sister hadn't contacted the Warren Commission and basically said, "Hey, don't you want to talk to this guy?" So that's the kind of investigation that was conducted. It wasn't much of an investigation, obviously, And in this case, you had the guy who shot the alleged assassin in front of 70 police officers, national TV, and really sparked the instant distrust that most of the American public had. Because once he shot, I remember as a 7-year-old just sitting there thinking, wow, he shot Oswald to shut him up. I mean, even a little kid can understand on a superficial level what was happening there. But our government apparently couldn't, or they were obviously complicit in some way, and they didn't want to find the answers. But yeah, it's reading Jack Ruby's testimony is, I mean, he was begging. He at one point says, "Come on, you can get more out of me." I mean, he was asking him, "Come on, you know, scratch a little more here." But
we will scratch a little more, Don. Just hold on. We'll take a time out. Hidden History and Exposé of Modern Crimes, Conspiracies and Cover-ups in American Politics, right here on the Conspiracy Show. My name is Richard Serrett. Don't go away.
PIN numbers, passcodes, social insurance numbers. If they make you wonder how private they are, here's two more numbers. 416-360-0740 or toll-free at 1-866-740-4740. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740. Fasten your seatbelt and put your tray in the upright position. You're about to leave everything you know behind on The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Just a programming note, next week on the program, Stanton Friedman, Kathleen Marden in the first hour, noted UFO researcher. Before we get back to our conversation with Don Jeffries, Hidden History, I just want to finish up our What's in the Box segment. And people are tweeting in the hashtag What's in the Box. I think next week we'll change up the hashtag. What's in the Box is kind of a very popular hashtag for other items. But right now we're using hashtag What's in the Box. Carlsberg at 84 is guessing cutlery. Francisco Vargas says a walnut. Aubrey Batchelor says a dice. Let's see. Someone down here, Mr. Sinister says cigars. Just because it's a humidor doesn't mean there are cigars in there. No, sorry. Then we have at Gage Preston, Red Rose. No. And then, now this is interesting, Bellatrix. At Bellatrix, a shoe polish tin. That's pretty close. Albert, one final guess. Do you want to try one more time before we...
Something rectangular, like an old battery?
Sorry, my friend. Let's open it up.
All right.
What's in the box? Look at that. It's a hockey puck. And I'm not talking Don Rickles here. Dating myself again with a Don Rickles reference. However, it is a hockey puck. So I thought Bellatrix was pretty close with a shoe polish tin. Those of you who actually polish your shoes, does anyone shoe polish anymore? Anyway, that's the right shape. Absolutely. We'll get a hold of Bellatrix. I don't know if she's in the Toronto area, but if she is... We'll award her the book prize. Bellatrix, well done. Okay, let's get back to our conversation with Don Jeffries. And we were talking about the Jack Ruby testimony before the Warren Commission. And he said that he had to get out of Dallas. His life was in jeopardy. He testified before Gerald Ford and Justice Warren. He said something else about a meeting that took place in his club, the Carousel Club. Was Officer Tippett, the guy that was shot as he tried to apprehend Oswald, was Tippett not in a meeting at the Carousel Club with someone?
Well, there had been allegations that Mark Lane made a good deal about that. And some of those things, they weren't proven because nothing was investigated. Because what would happen, even when people like Ruby would try to give them leads, I mean, Ruby did try to do that. He would try to steer them, hey, investigate this. And they just weren't interested in investigating. Hey, there's loads of evidence, and I go into it in Hidden History, that Ruby and Oswald knew each other. And there is some evidence that Tippett knew them as well. And Ruby was so friendly with everyone in the Dallas Police Department that it's very unlikely that he had not... at least run across Tippett, if not, being friendly with him, because he was very friendly. At the very least, he was kind of a cop go-getter. He would run and bring sandwiches and coffee to the guys and, you know, and then they would try to turn the other way, I guess, if the something untoward happened at a strip club. And he, I believe, all the officers free drinks and so forth. But there was a lot there that they could have investigated, even on that level. And again, there was a early on, especially the master of ceremonies in his club, a comedian, some of the strippers. They all talked about having seen Oswald in the Carousel Club, but that got swept down the memory hole, like so much of the what happens in all these narratives. The early stuff is forgotten, and everybody was mistaken, and so forth. And some of them die, some of them disappear, and clearly, it is, if you study this, you just see that there was absolutely no investigation conducted at all of Ruby or anyone else.
Do young people still care about the JFK assassination? It's that old Dennis Miller line when you say, "Where were you when JFK was shot?" And they say, "What? You mean the Oliver Stone movie?" do young people that you speak to, or do they care? Do they know about it?
Well, I think they know enough about it to realize how significant it was, and I think they realize what a significant event it was. And in retrospect, of course, JFK looks better and better compared to the presidents that came after him. So I think when they see him speak and they see film clips of him and understand he had this movie star good looks, which always helps, you know, your reputation, helps your likability factor, I think they look and just listen to what he was saying. Certainly if they listen to his secret society speech, gets a lot of play in the conspiracy community. So I'm sure that lots of young people have heard that. And even though he was pretty much directly talking about communism, it just sounds so wonderful to hear a president talking about that stuff, and it's music to anybody who's chasing down these rabbit holes' ears, because it can apply to anything, and people have used it to apply to other groups or the group that runs everything, if there is a group that runs everything. And it's like nothing any other president said before. In that conjunction, a lot of them have also heard his American University peace speech.
Right.
June 1963, which is, again, I believe, one of the greatest, if not the greatest speech ever given.
And may have been the nail in his coffin, too.
Yeah, I think that was the final nail, definitely. I think the plans went out right after that, because you never hear anybody talk about that. I mean, you just giving your enemies credit for being mortal just like you, and they breathe the same air we breathe, and they want the best future for their children. You just aren't used to hearing any politician talk like that, and just a wonderful speech in retrospect to look at what we have, where we've come since then in the 53 years, and just to imagine any politician really, other than on the fringes. I mean, you know, my friend Cindy Sheehan, people like that, certainly you can envision them making speeches like that, or even more radical. But any mainstream politician that has a chance to be elected president or even Senate, to come up with a speech like that today is unthinkable, because they just... That you wouldn't have that kind of spirit of thinking of being, you know, walking a mile in somebody else's moccasins and understanding that, hey, they're human beings too, and, you know, do we really want this to happen? And it's very important, especially now when there's so much anti-Russian fervor that's being whipped up, especially on the left, which is ironic.
Yes.
I've gotten in several arguments on Facebook with liberals about this. I said, you know, aren't you the same guys that, you know, wanted us to have detente with the Soviet Union and said we have to have peace with them, look the other way when they took over this country or that country and ruled with an iron hand, and somehow you're expecting us to believe that Russia now is more dangerous than they were then? So it's really laughable to see that, because that's one of the refreshing things really to come out of Trump, is there's still that spirit, I think, there of wanting to get along with Russia. I think it's real important. I don't think any sane person should want World War III.
Kennedy and Khrushchev had developed some very interesting back-channel communications. I think in many respects, Khrushchev was sort of being perceived by the national security apparatus in his country the same way that Kennedy was by the hawks in his. The two of them were trying desperately to sort of get together and work something out, but neither of the... their camps wanted that to happen. We'll take another time out, come back, and one final segment with Don Jeffries, Hidden History, an expose of modern crimes, conspiracies, and cover-ups in American politics. Stay with us.
Providing the evidence and letting you draw your own conclusions. This is The Conspiracy Show with Richard Sarrett on Zoomer Radio. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Sarrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740. The owners of the system are asleep. Now we can play. The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. I just want to let listeners know that Hidden History isn't just about the JFK assassination. It talks about the Franklin cover-up, the child sex scandals, the death of William Colby, CIA director, the Bush body counts, part one and two. I want to jump ahead out to we were talking about Kennedy, but I want to talk about the death of John F. Kennedy Jr. And this is a little more obviously recent history, 1999. Many of us of a certain age will remember that very well. But some things that you point out in there that I had forgotten about John Jr.'s death, and that was that it took 15 hours. You know, by the time the Saratoga plane went into the drink, before they actually initiated a search, 15 hours? That seems incomprehensible.
Yeah, nothing about as a local reporter told me when I emailed him, nothing seemed right about that event. You look at 9:39 p.m. phone call. I think that's the key to it, where I have unedited original VHS footage that another researcher kindly sent to me early on that he recorded live, and it's a good thing he did because later researchers got the same footage, and all references to that 9:39 p.m. phone call have been edited out. But if you have the real footage, it's constant. They talk about JFK was called the flight tower at 9:39 p.m. And was said everything was fine and was awaiting landing instructions. That became important later on because 9:39 p.m. is the official time we're told that the plane went into a death spiral. So, and what's more incredible is that the one local station had an interview with the Coast Guard Petty Officer Todd Bergen, who and it was just about that phone call. Now, the Coast Guard was not going to send someone to talk about a phone call that never happened. And yet, a few days, the next day or whatever, a couple days later into the coverage, after the plane, the remains were found, the FAA came on and said, no, there was never any contact. So that 9:39 p.m. phone call went down the drain. It was reported by UPI, very detailed. And again, they gave an interview on the subject. The reporter that gave that interview, I emailed her three times. She never replied to me. And I couldn't find the Todd Bergen, the Coast Guard petty officer either. So, but I think that's the most important piece of evidence we have, because obviously it was crucial to the official narrative, because it was almost impossible to believe that the plane went into a death spiral at the exact moment that JFK Jr. was contacting the authorities and saying everything was fine. He was waiting landing instructions. And we also have the lie, the myth that the weather was bad that night, JFK was breathless. I have all the evidence in the book. I talked to Edward Meyer, who wrote the official weather report for the FAA that night, is still angry all these years later about how misrepresented the facts were about this case in the media. And he said, you know, the weather was fine that night. It wasn't dangerous to fly. JFK Jr. was plenty qualified, and he wasn't reckless. So that's the story of, you know, from someone who wrote the official weather report that night. But instead we had this dramatic, the typical kind of Kennedy curse stories, and, you know, those Kennedys, they're reckless, and he shouldn't have done this, and another one unfortunately dies unnaturally. And it just happened to be right when he was ready to enter the world of politics. And, of course, I found out from talking to people behind the scenes, too, that JFK Jr. had a real quest to find out who killed his father. Unlike most of the Kennedys, he was very interested in his father's assassination. And, in fact, he was about to launch an investigation in George Magazine, as Wayne Madsen told me, that he was about to meet with JFK Jr., be hired specifically to investigate the assassination of his father. So there was a lot. There were a lot of reasons for the same forces that killed his father to want to silence him.
The just sticking with the the investigation or lack thereof of the plane crash. You write in the book how the black box, which would have normally have been a recording of all of the cockpit conversation, and that that call would have been recorded on the black box. What happened to the black box?
Yeah, I believe they ever found it, and there are so many things about that. One of the switches was put into an off position. I talked to a pilot that was familiar with flying those Saratoga planes, and he could have, even if he had gotten in trouble, he could have glided the distance to land. I mean, those planes are made that way, and again, the weather wasn't that bad that last night. If you can see the way I wrote in the book, I kind of showed how the official narrative developed, where you had certain people coming out and you know, kind of anonymous pilot saying, yeah, I tried to fly that night. That was crazy. You know, no one should have been out there. When, in fact, if you look online, you can still see the radar reports that night. It wasn't bad. And as I said, the Edward Meyer, who wrote the official report, investigated just specifically the weather that night for the FAA, was incensed on the way this inaccurate way it was portrayed in the media. The weather wasn't bad, and JFK wasn't reckless. So there's a lot about that event. Obviously, it's like all these events. It wasn't investigated at all, and you're considered a crazy conspiracy theorist if you even ask these questions.
You're also right here. The all planes have the emergency locator transmitter, the ELT, and that would send out a beacon signal when a crash occurs, and yet it took them 5 days still to find the plane.
Yeah, you see, I think they would have been able to follow that signal quicker. I mean, everything about it was, I mean, why was the military involved? JFK Jr. never served in the military. There was no reason for that. President Clinton kind of overtook the entire investigation, and it was portrayed as because he loved the Kennedys so much, and he wanted to make sure this was, well, you know, he overreached. I don't believe he had the authorization to do that, and the military certainly didn't. And then the way the bodies were cremated so quickly, when the Kennedys are Catholics, and I couldn't find any other record of any other Kennedys being cremated. I mean, I'm a Catholic, and most of us don't believe in cremation. He was cremated quickly, their body, you know, the ashes dumped at sea, and if people read the chapter on it, you can find the Boston Globe, even people like that were questioning, and they quoted people about how quickly the autopsies were done, how superficial they were, and how fast the process moved. It was really too quick to do any kind of real investigation. The entire thing was swept under the rug, and it's considered just another entry in the Kennedy curse, but I think it was a lot more than that.
Do we know whether he was serious about making a run for the Senate for New York State?
Well, if he wasn't going to run that year, I mean, yeah, there's a whole school of thought, and I believe Roger Stone's one of those who thinks that believes that, you know, this, he could be another member of the Clinton body count because he would have challenged Hillary Clinton for the New York Senate race. I don't know that specifically, but I do know, again, from talking to people behind the scenes, that he's only 39 years old, so he was still very young, and he was about to launch his, and I believe he probably, pretty much like the other Kennedys, especially Robert Kennedy, I think he was probably impatient. They didn't want to be like Ted Kennedy and serve, you know, 40 years in the Senate or whatever. He wanted to go for the top because I think he wanted the answers. He wanted to try to expose who killed his brother, who killed his father and his uncle. And so I believe he may have waited and just tried to run for the presidency. But I think he would have been an unbeatable candidate. I mean, he certainly would have had the female vote because of his looks, and he didn't have any baggage attached to him like some of the other Kennedys. He'd led a clean life and had a beautiful wife. So I think he would have been a very, very hard candidate to beat. I think visions of Camelot would have been restored, and I think he would have been swept into whatever office he wanted to run for.
And I'm trying to remember who I was talking to who suggested that the name of his publication, George, he wasn't sort of referencing George Washington. He was pointing people in the direction, he was announcing who was responsible for his father's murder. Was that you?
No, I didn't say that. That's probably a reference to people who believe George Bush
right.
was involved. You know, I don't know that at all, but I do know that he had already, you know, he had a very bold article about the assassination of Rabin in Israel, and he had also had an interview with Oliver Stone. And I point out in the book, he went to one of the White House correspondents' dinners with his guest was Larry Flint. And Larry Flint was more controversial than being a publisher of Hustler magazine was the fact that he was a very vocal anti-Warren, you know, critic of the Warren Commission. He had offered $1 million for to find the real murderers of John F. Kennedy. So these are the people that, you know, really behind the scenes John F. Kennedy Jr. knew and was associated with. So I don't think there's any question that he had kind of an old Shakespearean kind of urge to find out who maybe to avenge his father's death. But and as I've said before, I think all these deaths are connected, and that I don't think Robert F. Kennedy would have ever been assassinated if John F. Kennedy hadn't, and I don't think Ted Kennedy would have ever had Chappaquiddick, which was his political assassination, I believe, and I certainly don't think John F. Kennedy Jr. would have died in that plane crash if the Kennedys hadn't done something to offend the powers that be way back when.
Just about out of time here, but do you think the final chapter has been written on the Clinton dynasty?
Well, I hope so, but who knows? I mean, Chelsea Clinton is said to be wanting to enter politics, so I would never say, but I think, again, I think the public is becoming awake, and that's why the Trump presidency is going to be so interesting, because people are going to be so crushed and disillusioned. I'll be the first one to go after him, too, if he doesn't live up and he just becomes another, you know, another Bush administration. And I think people saw so much of Hillary, and they're tired of, even the people that voted for Hillary Clinton really wanted Bernie Sanders, most of them.
Yes.
They want something, they want stronger voices. They don't want this inside. And so I think they would blanch at a Chelsea Clinton, much as they blanched at Jeb Bush when he tried to become the third Bush there. And Jorge Bush, I think, is the next one in line that's, you know, trying to enter politics. So I think they don't want any more of these dynasties. And again, if nothing changes under Trump, I think the next election is going to be even more interesting, because you're going to have some real outsiders that are pushing there. And with the growth of the Internet and the death of the dinosaur media and the fact that no one trusts them anymore, I think you're going to have more and more voices, you know, alternative voices that are pushing for real reform. And sooner or later, hopefully, we get real reform.
I agree. As nasty as distasteful as this election was, that's the one force for good that came out of it, is that finally the lie of an unbiased mainstream media has been laid to waste. Donald, always a pleasure. And again, the third edition of Hidden History, an expose of modern crimes, conspiracies, and cover-ups in American politics, with a foreword by Roger Stone, available to book buyers now, Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble in the U.S., I'm guessing?
Yes.
Donald, thank you again.
Thank you for having me.
Be well, my friend.
Bye. You too.
All right, the website for this program, your portal, really, is strangeplanet.ca. Explore. Check it out. There's a radio section for this program, The Conspiracy Show. Click on the radio page. Register as a member. There's that blue member-only area or blue member area button. Register. It's fast, easy, and free. That gains you access to all sorts of member-only features like past show audio archives, the book club, etc., etc. And please say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett. S-Y, because I love you, R-E-T-T. As always, follow the truth.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740. Live from Toronto, Canada, Earth, The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett on Zoomer Radio.
Thanks for inviting me into your home, your long-haul truck, camper, taxi, your parents' basement, your loft, that greasy spoon just off the interstate, and your cabin in the woods. A special hello to all of you listening in on our flagship station, Zoomer Radio, 50,000 watts of peace and love. One of the largest broadcast footprints in North America, that's AM 740, but also 96.7 FM right here in Toronto. And of course, all of you listening in on one of our affiliate stations, the podcasts, of course, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn.com, iTunes, and TalkZone.com. Those of you who take the show with you on your mobile device with the Zoomer Radio and the Conspiracy Show apps, again, both free downloads. Those of you catching the live stream on YouTube through our HOA. And incidentally, if you want to join the HOA and watch this transmission being streamed live on YouTube, just go to my Twitter feed, at Richard Serrett. Go to the top or near the top of the feed, and you'll find a tweet containing the HOA link. Just click on it, and you're in. It's that simple. So however and wherever you're listening, I bid thee the warmest of welcomes, and I thank you for your fine company. Victor Vigiani, the executive director of Zealand Communications and a frequent guest here on The Conspiracy Show, is standing by, along with, we hope, we're trying to get him, UFO disclosure advocate Steve Bassett, who is the executive director of Paradigm Research Group in Washington. And Stephen has just recently, very recently, issued a stunning press release from PRG indicating he has been contacted by a source within the U.S. military intelligence community. The communication concerns the prospect of managing the disclosure of extraterrestrial-related issues under the current administration, officially making Barack Obama the disclosure president. Of course, that window is closing rapidly. We are less than, what are we, around 65 days until inauguration? Anyway, that conversation just moments away. Ian Robertson is here on the other side of the glass. Our technical producer, Albert Vinzel. Yes, let's get a shot of Ian for our folks on the HOA. There's Ian in his poor boy cap working the phones on the other side of the glass. And Albert Vinzel is here running our HOA. Let's also say hello to Ryan White, who is with us in studio. Ryan is our intern. Welcome aboard, Ryan, a former broadcast student of mine from Durham College and an exceptional young man with an exceptional mind. And we're happy to have you here, Ryan, with us. Now, we have Stephen Bassett. Excellent. Stephen Bassett is the executive director of Paradigm Research Group, founded in 1996 to end a government-imposed embargo on the truth behind the so-called UFO phenomenon. Stephen has spoken to audiences around the world about the implications of formal disclosure by world governments of an extraterrestrial presence engaging the human race. He's given thousands of radio and television interviews, and PRG's advocacy work has been extensively covered by national and international media. In 2013, PRG produced a citizens' hearing on disclosure at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. On November 5th, 2014, PRG launched a congressional hearing political initiative, seeking the first hearings on Capitol Hill since 1968 regarding the extraterrestrial presence issue and working to see the issue included in the ongoing presidential campaign. Stephen Bassett, welcome to you, sir.
Hi, Richard. It's good to be with you again.
Victor Vigiani is with us, the executive director of Z-Land Communications and a frequent guest here on the program. Victor, hello, my friend.
Good evening, sir. Good evening, Stephen. Great to be with you.
All right.
As always.
Stephen, let's get right to it. The communication you received, first of all, in what form did it take?
Text.
A text. And why are you confident of its providence?
I've been in this for 20 years, and I have some contacts. I have some access, not a lot, not as much as some. I know. This came in over encrypted text, which I just happened to set up about 10 days prior for another friend who just wanted to have me to have encrypted text for her, and it came in that way. So it's really that straightforward.
Okay.
Nothing more complicated than that. A tip, I guess you could say.
Right. And
I have a question for you, though, Richard.
Please.
We just had an election. I think most Canadians are generally aware of it. In your memory, has Canada ever had an election where the outcome was as dramatic or unusual as this one?
Not to my knowledge, no. Okay. No, not to my knowledge. I mean, we have the difference, of course, is being a parliamentary system and it's first-past-the-post system. We have multi-parties here. We don't have an electoral college system, so it's very different.
Course,
so we kind of avoid
but
a lot
still,
of
you
that.
You can have an outcome that could be what you would call a shock to the system or a disruption.
Well, we have had pollsters get it wrong, certainly, but never infused with this much acrimony from both sides and the aftermath. Nothing like this.
Okay, so this is a significant event comparable to some extraordinary events of the last 30 years. I mean, it's not just another election. And so history often happens at times like that. And the situation is this. I mean, I can only summarize it. I didn't even begin to discuss it in depth, but we've talked about parts of it in the past. But the situation is basically this, as I see it. I could be wrong. The Clintons and their close associates, having been denied the opportunity to deal with the ET issue during President Clinton's initial first term, dropped the matter going into the second election and made a decision that they would put it off for another day and never talk about it, which they did. They never talked about it. The words didn't come out their mouth regarding the Rockefeller Initiative. But I believe they made a decision that Secretary Clinton, and then First Lady Clinton, would eventually obtain the White House and she would be the disclosure president. First woman president, which is a modest legacy. There have been 68 or 9 other women who have been heads of state.
And Edith Wilson, who acted as president for about a year and a half.
Yeah, and you've had that. So, as legacies goes, it's not huge. But nevertheless, it's a milestone for the United States. But she would have been the disclosure president, which is perhaps will be one of the greatest legacies of any president. And that was the goal. And beginning in 2002, they began to sort of lay the groundwork for that, meaning creating a trail of breadcrumbs that history could look back and see the connection to the moment that she is the disclosure president, back all the way to her husband's efforts, which were stonewalled, just like Carter in 1993 to 1996. I think she felt she would get the White House in 2008. It didn't happen, which created a tough situation because the ET issue was maturing. The advocacy movement was making a lot of progress. And so 8 more years, tough call. I believe that for that reason, Obama was brought into the Clinton sphere. In fact, it's obvious that he was. They were not friends going into the transition period for Obama in 2008.
To say the least.
Nasty election. However, quickly they became friends, and I believe that's when Obama was sort of brought into the picture. This is easy because he selected John Podesta, Clinton's chief of staff and advisor during the Rockefeller Initiative, to form the new government in 2008. And then they selected Hillary Clinton for Secretary of State and Leon Panetta for Secretary of Defense. They tried to get Bill Richardson for Secretary of Energy, Commerce. All of these people were connected.
Governor of New Mexico, who was has right. also said some, you know, has also talked about UFO sightings and so forth.
That's correct. So he was in on it. The question was it going to happen under him? Nevertheless, and it didn't. And one of the reasons was the nature of his administration. It was a very odd situation. He came in under an enormous financial crisis that was not his doing. But nevertheless, the propaganda machine cranked up, and within 6 months, half the American people blamed it on him, such as the nation of propaganda. Took a huge hit in the midterms. And the opposition party was essentially arrayed against him, meaning they were going to do everything they could to prevent him from doing anything. And so it really made for a tough administration. And in spite of the fact that between 2008-2014, the advocacy movement made even greater strides, the issue continued to advance, Obama did not disclose. And then the campaign goes in high gear 2 years ago, and the pressure is building even more. The key to that was the citizen hearing on disclosure, which PRG produced at the National Press Club, generating 30 hours of testimony in front of 6 former members of Congress, then delivered that entire testimony to the House and Senate of the United States in November 2014, and then began soliciting the media intensely, directly in Washington, in early 2015. This put great pressure on the Clintons, and as a result, they were in a difficult spot. I believe that the goal was for her to get to the White House and disclose, but they might not make it. They had a long way to go. That was a 2-year campaign. And they needed to be prepared for the possibility the issue would blow out before achieving the White House. And so they began laying down more breadcrumbs, statement after statement after statement, appearance after appearance on talk shows, not only by her and her husband, but also Barack Obama and John Podesta, including strong statements to the media by her. This is extraordinary. No presidential candidate has ever said anything like this before. Meanwhile, over those 2 years, perhaps as many as 1,000 print articles in major publications, including foreign language around the world, were published all about the Rockefeller Initiative, about the Clinton connection, with links, hyperlinks to all the material, such as the nature of articles on the Internet. And I'm talking about papers like New York Times, Washington Post, Washington Times, Times of London, Chicago Tribune, and on and on.
Right. There was a real sea change in the way that this this discussion was being handled by the mainstream medium. It was no longer the tongue-in-cheek, derisive commentary.
And all of it was serious. There's almost no ridicule in this. This was serious print, partially because they were making serious statements. That was their intention, to show clearly that they took the issue seriously, which generated even more media, which then generated more statements. So we're moving forward. However, the issue did not explode ahead of, quote, obtaining the White House, primarily because we were blocked by the television media. The television journalism will not touch this issue. Their record is the worst. There are reasons for that. There are just six major networks, the three standard networks that operate under the FCC, government, essentially, mandate. And then you have the three cable networks, which are fighting amongst themselves all the time for a few thousand viewers. And so they won't rock the boat. All of the hosts of these shows are multimillionaires. They have no desire to rock the boat. And they control the debates. All of the debates and forums held on this election, and there's 35 of them, I think, all of them were moderated by television hosts who had the full command of the questions.
Let me just jump in here, Stephen. We're heading into a break.
Okay.
Stephen Bassett, Executive Director of Paradigm Research Group. Victor Vigiani, Executive Director of Zealan Communication News Network. Back with more of The Conspiracy Show right after this.
Take a look around. What do you really see? This is where you can tell all about it. The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett on Zoomer Radio. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740. In a democracy, we elect officials so we can sleep at night. So why are you up? 416-360-0740 or toll free at 1-866-740-4740.
Just a note at the bottom of the hour, open lines for the final half hour of this program. Open lines at the bottom of this hour. I'll give you the numbers now. 416-360-0740, 416-360-0740 in the Greater Toronto Area. Toll free from just about anywhere, 1-866-740-4740, 866-740-4740. That's coming up in 10, 11, 12 minutes time. All right, right now, Stephen Bassett, Executive Director, Paradigm Research Group, Victor Vigiani, Zealand Communications News Network. Stay with us. Stephen, you did an exemplary job of sort of succinctly summarizing why disclosure, UFO ET disclosure, did not happen under Barack Obama's watch, how the table was being set for it to occur under a Clinton presidency. That's now not going to happen. Because time is tight, let's just jump to this encrypted message you received. Can you share that with us?
The message is, I paraphrased it in the press release I put out. But look, I've got a preface to ask the audience not to know what I'm talking about here. And I've got time to do this. None of the candidates were asked a single question by any of the television moderators. Therefore, she was able to coast through all of those debates and in the clear heading for the White House. Well and good. But she lost. And she didn't lose to just anybody. She didn't lose to John McCain or Mitt Romney. She lost to a wild card, Donald Trump. And this was a shock to everyone and a shock to her. Her political career is over. And so the situation then changed dramatically. So she was not going to be the disclosure president. But there was still 60-some days for Barack Obama to be the disclosure president. Now, what are you looking for at that point? What do you expect? Here's what I've figured out. 10 months ago, the Pentagon approached a known UFO researcher who happened to be a known musician named Tom DeLonge of rock, of Blink 182
right.
And Angels and Demons. He, Angels and something, forget
what. Angels and Airwaves. And
Angels
he walked
and
away Airwaves. From a music career to dedicate his life to studying this issue.
Yeah. I mean, he still does some music, but he's been involved for 20 years. I knew about that a long time ago. And he knows this stuff. He was approached by the Pentagon. He said that they wanted to talk with him. He meet with him, high-level people. They wanted him to get information out. Now, this is about 10 months ago now, when Hillary Clinton was still considered to be, like, the front runner. She's going to be the president. So they kind of see what's coming, in a sense. They even gave him a 10-person advisory board. And then get information out in a way that would be comfortable for people. And so he wrote a book called Secret Machines. It's fiction, but it's not fiction. Documentary was being put together. A lot of people thought he was joking or he was hoaxing, but he wasn't. And in fact, this was confirmed when the Podesta emails were leaked by WikiLeaks.
Correct, right.
It's all in there. And of course, I have that up on my website. That was a very extraordinary thing. I mean, people think the Pentagon is just, what, for the hell of it? I'm going to get in touch with somebody for bringing information out? But that was 10 months ago. Now Hillary Clinton loses. She's not going to be the disclosure president. The tip that I got occurred just 2 days after the election was over. And the essence of it, there was no Q&A. The essence was simply this. And given that over 150 articles have been written about what PRG has been trying to do here, I'm completely connected to this issue in terms of the political media in Washington. And I wasn't surprised. The tip was this. There are people inside the military intelligence community who deal with this issue. In other words, they're the ones that manage it under declassification. The Secretary of Defense is not given this information. The Secretary of Defense is a political appointee. He's transitional. He's out of the loop. The President's out of the loop. The Congress is out of the loop. This whole business has been in constitutional breach for decades. It's a problem. But, you know, the people inside, they manage the issue. That's it. But the message was this. Many of them are ready to work with the SecDef if the SecDef reaches down to them. In other words, they're willing to bring this information to him if asked. Why? So the Secretary of Defense could go cut a deal with the White House, which is required if the president's going to disclose. Why? Because they want disclosure under Obama. Now, the earlier approach, I think, to Tom DeLonge was predicated on disclosure happening under Clinton, who I think planned to do it all along, but she didn't make it, and so they had to pick up the pace. They have 60 days. If now, and how will it happen? Clinton is done. She is finished politically, and she leaves her career in disgrace, like her husband ended his political career in disgrace. She was savaged for over a year by every scandal you can imagine. It was an awful campaign, and she lost to Donald Trump. This is not going out on top. But if she were to finally speak truth to power, if she were to take an interview with a high-level journalist and start getting into much more depth about the Rockefeller Initiative, opening the door for questions to her husband, to Richardson, to Panetta, to Stephanopoulos. George Stephanopoulos was involved in the Rockefeller Initiative. He was in the White House at the time. And then there's 17 private individuals who have yet to be interviewed by the media, amazingly enough, in the 23 years since it ended. She would literally create a media firestorm in almost overnight. And that media firestorm would eventually head for the Pentagon. And, of course, it is that that would literally force the Pentagon's hands, or the hand to cut that deal with the White House. And what I'm understanding is when the Secretary of Defense faced with that, he's got to know what the hell he's talking about. And so when he looks down or goes down into the agency and says, can somebody tell me what's going on here, there's people to answer him. And that's how it would happen very, very quickly. But it is virtually in Secretary Clinton's hands, virtually in her hands. It's possible it could come from another direction, but it's primarily hers to play. If she has two choices, I call it the Clinton's choice. It's her and her husband. They have two choices. They can speak truth to power, finally, and not just some truth, not just manipulated truth, but the real deal. And they can trigger disclosure under their Democratic president, Obama, get a great deal of the legacy themselves, and allow the government to get this out, settle down, put in some structures, so the next president will walk into a structured, stable situation. But the Democrats will be the disclosure party. Or they can continue to remain silent and allow the whole embargo, truth embargo, to pass on into the next administration for better or for worse. This is an historic decision that is sitting right before her. It is one of the most important decisions any presidential candidate has ever faced, and in the case of her husband, any former president has ever faced. And the Pentagon seems to be making a statement here. Of course, the media are ready to go, and that's where we are. And the time is short. If she's going to trigger this, she's got to do it soon, because it will take time for the pressure to build and the Pentagon to relent. And it has to happen soon enough, because you cannot have disclosure a week before the inauguration. You just
I wonder if I could just sort of interject there, Steve.
And Victor Vigiani, yes, CLN News Network.
Let's go back, just to back up a little bit here. There's an amazing amount of interest that I've garnered over the past 2 days. My website alone has had just about 1,000 hits about this whole situation that you're involved in. And people are burning to know one specific thing. Mm-hmm. Why have you been tapped on the shoulder to become part of this whole scenario in terms of managing the disclosure issue regarding.
I'm not managing it.
Well, no, what? No, what? How they? How you want to be part of, or how they may want you to be part of, to help them manage the situation. That's the perception that's out there, Steve.
It's a simple answer. For the last 2.5 years, I have been driving the media to the Clintons, generating most of those stories you've seen are being generated by PRG. I'm working with 36 journalists now from 36 publications, and 130-some stories about the Clinton-ET connection included direct references to PRG, links to the website, links to the Rockefeller Initiative document. I mean, I've been pushing this for 2.5 years. My publicist was involved for 3 months as well. And so I'm in the center of the storm. And so that's the tip.
Are you
by the way, that tip has several aspects to it. One, it's, quote, letting people know that it's letting me know, knowing that I would share this, that there's people in the Pentagon ready to cooperate with the SecDef. And, of course, they're also letting, indirectly, other people in the government know that there are people ready to cooperate, which may spurn others to cooperate. In other words, they're setting the basis for a quick action by the Pentagon leading to disclosure by the White House. And this is extremely important for this reason, and this is something that most people don't understand. There have been three fundamental issues running down through history since 1947. One is the extraterrestrial presence. The other is the truth embargo imposed by the U.S. government on the issue to contain it. And the third, which really doesn't get underway until 62, roughly, is the constitutional breach that has emerged. This constitutional breach was one of the key things that Eisenhower was warning us about in his farewell speech in January of 1961. Beware of undue influence of a military-industrial complex. Well, it's actually the military-intelligence-industrial complex. What happened was, is when the growing secret realm, the growing secret empire, pulled this issue out from under the Congress and the President, and out from other appointees, and then began pulling other USAPs, or unacknowledged special access programs, out from under the White House. This was a constitutional breach. It is illegal. Now, that was done for national security reasons, I understand. These people are good people. They have the safety of the country at heart. That's what they want. They're not rich. They make $100,000 a year. They're comfortable, but they don't have inside deals. They do it because they're serving their country. But nevertheless, it was a constitutional breach. So when Carter tried to get information, when Kennedy tried to get information, when Clinton tried to get information, they came right up against that breach. And they knew that if the Pentagon wasn't going to cooperate and they had to force them, which they could have done, Clinton could have called every single Joint Chiefs and every single top manager in the Pentagon and the CIA into the Oval Office, put them all in there, given them all a tuna fish sandwich, and said, you will start telling me everything about the ET issue, or I'm getting rid of all of you. But that would have publicly put the entire a constitutional breach literally out there, and the public would have learned that essentially the military intelligence community was in a coup relationship with the government, in a sense. For decades, it would have been an absolute massive can of worms, and none of the presidents were prepared to do that. ET thing is easy. There's ETs here. Wish we told you sooner. Here they are. But the constitutional breach is the problem. And so this addresses all of that. Why? Because, you see, if the Pentagon, under the pressure of the media, is able to provide information and get a deal cut with the White House, and then the president comes forward in an orderly fashion and announces the ET presence before they show up, like in the movie Arrival, then everything is the way it's supposed to be, and the constitutional breach is essentially not engaged. It will be dealt with one day, but not up front.
So the linchpin here, then, is to get Hillary to go to the press. Is the pressure that being exerted on her by these same people that sent you the message?
I have no idea, but I do know this. The print media is picking up on this. They're picking up on this Obama situation. There's already been 5, 6, 7 stories. There's plenty more coming, believe me. You're going to see story after story talking about these developments and why there is time for Obama to disclose this issue. Now, the question is, who in the journalistic stratosphere the power journalist is going to be the one that's going to go and confront Clinton, or who is she going to call? Maureen Dowd keeps coming up. Perfect choice. The point is that all she has to do is give a heart-to-heart, let her hair down with one, because one journalist, it's over. Oh, because the documents have been on the net for years, that the witnesses have come forward. This is all, this cake is bait. It just needs to be taken out of the oven. Does she have what it takes to do this? And psychologically, to me, it is a no-brainer. She will either go down in history as a failed candidate with a husband who left the office in disgrace, who could not beat a man who hardly spent any money and insulted virtually everybody in the world, or she can be the candidate, senator, first lady, who, along with her husband, finally said, look, people, you must know what's going on here. We tried to get the information. We were stonewalled, and then let the press take it from there and get the legacy, not only for herself and her husband, but also for the Democratic Party. Obama will be the disclosure president, and Donald Trump will be the first post-disclosure president.
All right, we have to leave it there. We'll keep on top of this and check in as the 60-plus days tick down, and we'll see how this develops. Stephen Bassett, Executive Director of Paradigm Research Group, thank you for this.
My pleasure.
Victor Vigiani, thank you, my friend.
Thank you for being so open with us. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Open lines when we come back, 416-360-0740. If you'd like to respond to that disclosure, that bombshell from Stephen Bassett, Barack Obama will be. There's still time for him to be the disclosure president. You can weigh in on that or any other matter. Toll free from out of town, 866-740-4740.
You're listening to The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740. Poking holes in the darkness. The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio. To see the light, call Richard now at 416-360-0740 or toll free at 1-866-740-4. 740.
Welcome back. Say hello on Twitter and please follow at Richard Serrett, SYRETT, at Richard Serrett. I've been getting tweets lately, people asking me whether I did the voiceover for a Honda commercial recently on television. I wish. I'm available, but that was not me. I actually happened to listen to it. And I don't know, one of the things is the music in this Honda commercial. I don't know if any of the gentlemen here have seen it. It's the recent campaign on TV. But the music is sort of very etheric, and it sounds like the closing music, the Danny Elfman piece we play at the end of the show. So that, coupled with the voiceover artist on the commercial, sounds a little bit like me towards at the beginning and then not so much at the end. Anyway, no, it wasn't me doing the Honda commercial, although I am available. The other thing I'm getting a lot of is Pizzagate. People want me to do something on Pizzagate, and I'm thinking about it, but understand, those of you not familiar, this involves, with the WikiLeaks, recent WikiLeaks revelations and the Podesta emails and all of these references to Washington insiders talking about pizza and cheese pizza, and somehow this is a code word, and somehow it references some sort of child sex ring going on in Washington, and it's just gone viral. People are crazy about it. And you have to understand, although I talk about things that are a little out there, I'm still functioning in the mainstream media, and there is still the matter of a broadcast license that has to be retained. And while I'm sitting here in this chair, I am responsible for that and must act responsibly. So, yes, it's a big story. Is there any truth to it? I don't know. I've seen some pretty interesting evidence, but evidence is not necessarily proof. What I want you to understand is this is something that I have to tread very carefully with. And so I'm thinking about it. I need to figure out how I would handle such a discussion. We can't mention names and make accusations on this program. It will not happen. However, I am thinking about how we could handle a story like this. But again, we have to act responsibly. All right. We will Let's see. Oh, we don't have a lot of time. Should we wait then? Okay. Why don't we do that? We'll take a break. When we come back, we will dip into the phones and we'll talk to Dave in New Jersey and Jim in South Carolina and Jay in Florida and Alan in Alaska. Open lines, 416-360-0740, toll free from just about anywhere, 866-740-4740.
Different views make great conversation. This is The Conspiracy Show with Richard Sarrett on Zoomer Radio. To speak with Richard live, call 416-360-0740 or toll free at 1-866-740-4740. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Sarrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740. Question everything. This is The Conspiracy Show with Richard Sarrett on Zoomer Radio.
All right, we will get to the other calls, but I quickly wanted to work in Victor Vigiani, who was with us the last half hour, along with Stephen Bassett, the executive director of Paradigm Research Group. We were talking about this cryptic or encrypted message, text, that Bassett received from a source within the military intelligence community saying that there's a consensus there now and they're pressuring, apply pressure for Barack Obama to disclose the UFO ET presence before he leaves office in 60 plus days. So I just wanted to work Victor in here very quickly with a last word before we move on. Victor, thanks for hanging out.
Yes.
All right. So I don't know if we actually I mentioned to Stephen we were tight for time, and he said he had time to sort of preface it, but I don't know that we actually got to the meat of the actual text, did we?
Not really. And
no.
That was kind of disappointing for me because we're trying to figure out, at least I am anyways, I'm trying to figure out the huge amount of interest that has been thrown my way specifically in terms of what happened after he announced that he had received this encrypted message.
Okay. Do you have the summary off his press release that you can read to us or...
I think I actually just shut it down a moment ago, but I can bring it up here if you want. Okay, let me see.
And people can go. They can go to PRG or they can go to zlandcommunications.blogspot.ca,
yeah.
And they can read it. And again, this is a summary of the text that he received again from someone within the military intelligence community.
That's right. Yeah. Essentially, what it said was the message stated: persons who are directly involved in the management of the extraterrestrial issue want disclosure to take place under President Obama, and we are ready to work with the Secretary of Defense if approached. That's the essence of what the message that he received.
Okay, I think he did mention. Yeah, he did. He did relate that. Then, mm-hmm. All right. I wasn't sure if we got the gist of it. All right. So, but it's worth repeating.
Mm-hmm. Well, the essence of the whole thing is why, first of all, I would love to have a more specific answer from Steve on why he felt he was tapped on the shoulder to become a participant in this. I don't think Steve really fully explained, to my satisfaction anyways, why he was tapped on the shoulder to be a participant in this whole scenario and what his role might be in all of this and why he was chosen. I know that Steve has made it very clear in the past and in some of his emails that he was considered sort of an irritant among people who were observing his work from the White House and within the government as an irritant.
Well, perhaps because, as he said, he's now working with some 36 journalists. Maybe they feel that he is the quickest route to get this message out, to get the ball rolling. I don't know. To me, the big question is why not? Why does it have to be Obama? Why does it have to be Clinton? Why can't it be Trump? If the military intelligence community are ready to disclose, why can't they simply, and maybe Stephen address this, but why can't they simply contact the Secretary of Defense and say, we have to have a meeting?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And I think that it has to do with a lot, you know, in terms of, you know, personal pride and what the Democratic Party really wants to happen with this. They want to take control of how this issue is brought forward. And I think the non sequitur of having a Donald Trump take over or at least be introduced to the fact that this is brand new to him, or would this be something that he gets dumped in his lap by President Obama within the next 65 days? There's a real difference here, as far as I'm concerned. It's one thing to be, you know, a sitting president and having been briefed on this and then come forward and say something about it publicly and then let your successor take over. I mean, if nothing happens and Donald Trump is the one who brings this thing forward, that's one thing. But it's an entirely different scenario if President Obama wants to become the disclosure president and dumps this whole thing in Donald Trump's lap. And as far as I'm concerned, if that happens, President Trump won't know which way to look, or even understand the whole issue. Because I'm convinced that this issue has been so well-groomed under President Obama that he wants to be the one to do it. And I guess he's just looking for permission one way or another.
Well, final question, Victor, and that is, why do we need it to come from Barack Obama? If we have the former First Lady, the Secretary of State, and the former president going to the media and saying, yes, it's true, this is what we know, this is what, you know, why isn't that enough?
Well, no, I think it's plenty. If that's in fact how things happen, I mean, that would be one of the, there are two criteria here. You want it to happen with a sitting president, or do you want to let that go by and then eventually have Podesta and the Clintons bring this thing forward on their own as regular citizens? That's another scenario altogether. And I completely agree with you. It could go one way or another. But I think that the pressure on the president to have his own name in history as being the disclosure president, I think that means a lot to him personally, because he's spoken about it so often and has witnessed Podesta being part of this whole process as far back as 2001. And why would Obama bring in a Podesta to have so much influence within the White House over the past 2.5 to 3 years? There's a reason for that. So I think there's a matter of pride here and maybe even ego. But like you said, I mean, if this goes by without anything happening with President Obama, and it does eventuate that the Podestas of the world and the Clintons of the world bring this forward in their own way with journalists, that's another matter altogether, which probably may have a bigger impact and probably, in my estimation, throw in a bit of revenge to Donald Trump to say, here, we can reach back from the grave and affect your presidency by disclosing this information. Now you deal with it, Mr. President.
Well, Victor, thank you. I don't know. I think if they're going to do it, Podesta and Clinton, they better do it quickly, because there could be a special prosecutor in their future and an orange pantsuit in Hillary's future.
Well, that's entirely possible, too.
All right, Victor, thank you so much.
Okay, thanks a lot. Goodbye, Richard.
Goodbye, my friend. Dave is in New Jersey. Dave, welcome to the Conspiracy Show. Good morning.
Hi, thank you very much. I know you're limited for time, but I got a question for you, and I wanted to thank your guests. They were very interesting. Have you ever heard of, from 1960, something from the government called Mark IV, Roman numeral IV, controlled display system? It was an Air Force government contract that was made up for the U.S. Air Force.
No, I haven't. I haven't heard about Mark IV, Dave.
Yeah, and basically, I've been researching this for months and months and months. The only reason I even found out about it was a random thing. I actually have, literally, and I have it in front of me right now, the booklet that was made for them. It was acquired by me in an estate sale from, I guess, the guy who worked for the government, because when I read this, it blew me away. Just to give you an idea, it was basically 30, they were trying to invent, and this is before we even got a man into space just up and down, but it was they're building already, planning a 30-day, basically four-person ship that could last 30 days in space with space weapons. And I can't find anything anywhere about it, and I've been researching this for months and months. I have an Air Force contract number. I don't want to say it on the air, but I just don't know if that was the only thing I thought was maybe a couple of years later. They came out with the dinosaur, DYNA-SOUR. I don't know if this is a predecessor to it. And this was made by Lear Incorporated.
And what's the date stamp on it? Is there a date stamp?
Yes, July 1960, prepared by Advanced Engineering Division, Lear Inc., July 1960.
July 1960. Okay, so we had Sputnik is already out. And we hadn't sent a man into space.
I spent hours and hours online and couldn't find anything whatsoever. And the only thing I found was there's some game where they have a mock-up of it where it's very similar to what this actually is. But this book was made in 1960. There would be no reason to fake this book. And the way I got it, there was no reason. But it's in great detail, and it basically has 5 nuclear warheads on it.
Dave, do me a favor. There's a couple of things I would suggest, because you know, I'm a talk show host, and this is an area that I'm fascinated with. But I'm not the expert in this area. Why you might want to reach out to someone like a Richard Dolan.
Actually, I did try for 2 months, Literally, I sent him 5 emails. I tried to even get on the show, and I finally got in touch with him while he was doing a show, and he told me, I'm live, don't bother me.
All right.
So I got so depressed that he was my number one guy. I wanted to get him.
I'm sorry to hear that. Okay, so here's the other thing. Next week on the program, I have Stanton Friedman. Why don't you call in that first hour of next week's...
He's my second girl who I've been following my whole life, yeah.
Okay, call in, and we will make sure you get on with Stanton, okay?
And when is that?
Next week.
I definitely will.
11 p.m.
If you could just write down my name and number, I will call you.
All right, I'll put you back on hold, and we'll make sure that Dave from New Jersey gets on next week. Thank you for that. Jim is on
Thank you.
Jim in South Carolina. Hi, Jim. Welcome.
Good morning.
Hi there.
The Georgia Guidestones, I heard you mention it on a previous show, and there was a television program. The host was Scott Walther. He went and interviewed the banker that did the planning and coordination for the entire Guidestone building.
And for the people that don't know about the Georgia Guidestones, these are these big stones sticking out of the ground in Georgia, and they have the inscription on them almost sounds like, you know, a New World Order's wet dream. They talk about, you know, how the population needs to be reduced to like 500 million or something. So
500 million.
Right, right. And some people think that these were placed there by, you know, the Illuminati or whomever. And so what did you discover, Jim, in this documentary? The banker who bought the land where the stones are and so forth?
Right. The banker stated that someone came into his bank, gave him a large sum of money with instructions of exactly what he wanted built, which would become the Georgia Guidestones. And Scott Walther found this banker and interviewed him. And the banker said that the person did mention the New World Order in their conversations and planning. I don't understand. It was built at great expense, I believe, in 1980.
Right.
And it is in the middle of nowhere.
Hmm. Sounds like we got to get Scott. Was it Scott Walker?
Or Walther.
Walther.
I'm not sure how he spells it, but it's Walther.
Okay.
He has a show on the History Channel. I think it's America Unearthed.
Okay. Oh, yes, yes, yes. All right. I'll see if I can get in touch with him, Jim, and see if we can get him on the program. That would be great.
Right.
Okay.
And sometime, if you would like, I've gone down there a couple of times for this just a short hour and a half drive. Get my number, and I'll be glad to do a video chat with you, and you can actually take a look around from Canada.
Oh, that would be great. All right. We'll put you on hold, and Ian will get your name. I just very quickly want to say hello to Alan in Alaska. Alan, thank you for checking in. How are you, my friend? Alan in Alaska. Hello.
Hello.
Hi there. Thanks for calling in. Whereabouts in Alaska are you?
In the interior.
All right. And how are you picking us up?
On YouTube. This first time I've listened real time. It's great.
Ah, welcome. Glad to have you. We just have about 90 seconds, Alan. So what did you want to talk about?
Just a couple of comments. I keep hearing Mr. Bassett talking about the disclosure issue, and I just listened to him, and I think who would believe these folks he's talking about? They've lied to us so many times. And if they did have this information, we would already know it because it would have been on WikiLeaks a long time ago.
I think that makes...
That if it does come out, it'll be just to leave a mess for the incoming president.
I think there's a great deal of truth in what you're saying, Alan. If it came from Podesta's mouth, I mean, who would believe him anyway at this point?
Exactly.
I think he's tainted. Likewise, the Clintons. However, I think Bassett is trying to sort of separate that from, you know, what do they in fact know? And he points back to the Rockefeller Initiative, and Lawrence Rockefeller did contact the Clinton White House. We know that for sure. The other question is, you know, would at this point, let's say Hillary did somehow sneak by and win the presidency, you know, would they share information with her at this point? I mean, would she even qualify to have security clearance? I highly doubt that. Alan in Alaska, thank you so much. I hope you'll call again. My thanks
thank you,
to bye-bye. Ian Robertson from The Ruthless Ones. They gig in and around town. Next time they're out touring, we'll let you know. Albert Vinzel, my erstwhile remote viewer. Albert, you got to pick up your game, my friend. No pressure. And thanks to Ryan White also, our intern. We appreciate him dropping by as well tonight. Back next week with a brand new program, Stanton Friedman, Kathleen Martin. Part of the program, hope you'll be along as well. In the meantime, don't be afraid. There's nothing concealed that won't be revealed and nothing hidden that won't be made known. What you hear in the dark, speak in the light. What I say in a whisper, proclaim from the housetops. Move over, Aphrodite, I'm coming home. Good night.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.